All right. Well, since we're sort of in a testing phase now, I'm just going to pick something to read here and read it and see what happens. So I have here a copy of Atom, the magazine of the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority. This is number 194, December 1972. There's an address by Sir John Hill entitled The Role of Nuclear Energy in the Total Energy Mix. It says, "The following paper was presented by Sir John Hill, Chairman of the UK Atomic Energy Authority and British Nuclear Fuels Limited, on 13 November to the 1972 International Conference of the U.S. Atomic Industrial Forum held in Washington, in conjunction with the American Nuclear Energy Society's International Winter Meeting. The general theme of today's session is nuclear energy and the quality of life, and it is in that context, therefore, that I would like to put before you some thoughts about the role of nuclear energy in the total energy mix. This involves, it seems to me, consideration of the total itself, that is, today, total world energy consumption, as well as of the mix. Some idealists argue that the way to improve the quality of life is to renounce technology and all its works and to return to primitive simplicity. But realists must accept, I suggest, that improvements in the quality of life depend on, and must be sustained by, increases in economic output. Even quite modest assumptions about world economic growth point to a dependence on energy by the end of the century which can, in my opinion, be met sensibly only by major recourse to nuclear energy. I do not think anyone who has studied the figures for the growth and consumption of fossil fuels and considered the best estimates of world reserves would seriously challenge this assertion. It must, however, be said that the position of gas, where reserves are relatively small, oil, where reserves are substantially larger, and coal, with its enormous reserves, present very different timescales. I mention timescales here because any paper dealing with the role of nuclear power is inevitably going to rely heavily upon predictions of long-term changes. It is my experience that this type of prediction usually gets the general pattern right, but is frequently fallible or even inaccurate when it comes to time scale. To show that I approach these subtle problems of prediction with due care and skepticism, perhaps I should start off by describing how some predictions of energy consumption in the UK went quite seriously wrong, and with the brilliance that always accompanies the clarity of hindsight, explain what went wrong. I should add that the present quite severe difficulties facing the nuclear industry and the heavy electrical industry in the UK is in substantial part attributable to this situation. Let me go back to pre-1952, when the average house in Britain was heated by burning raw coal in an open fireplace. Such a fire was pleasant to sit beside and quite inexpensive. It had the disadvantage that in many cases the rest of the house was pretty cold, and it was the principal cause of fogs and air pollution. In the winter of 1952, London experienced a period of strong atmospheric inversion, which resulted in one of the worst smogs that the capital has experienced. Subsequently, statistics showed that several thousand people with respiratory ailments died prematurely as a result of this severe pollution. Rightly, the environmental lobby, as it has now become, pressed for legislation to prevent a recurrence, and in 1956, the first of the Clean Air Acts of Parliament was passed. This made it illegal to emit smoke in designated areas of our cities and effectively prohibited the burning of coal in those areas. Progressively, the British householder gave up his beloved but inefficient and dirty open coal fire and switched to electricity, manufactured town gas, and in the larger houses to oil. Town gas was not cheap, at that time being manufactured largely by the carbonization of coal, and there was a big movement to electrical heating. The growth in electricity demand increased from 7% per annum, which had been the average growth rate for a very long time, to 8%, 9%, and 10% and above in the period up to 1962. By the time this trend was clearly discernible amongst the normal scatter of statistics, the electricity boards were seriously short of a plant, and with the demand going up rapidly, the ordering rate was stepped up from about 2,000 megawatts per annum to 6,000 megawatts per annum to overcome the backlog and meet the rising demand. However, Other changes were also taking place on a slightly different timescale. The gas industry was undergoing a double technical revolution in no less than 5 years. The first was the gasification of light oils, which substantially reduced the cost of production of town gas. The second was the discovery of substantial quantities of natural gas in the North Sea, which could be produced on a heat basis much more cheaply than coal. The economic balance between gas and electricity was changed substantially, and there was a massive swing to the use of gas to the detriment of all the other fuels, including electricity. By 1965, the electricity boards found themselves in the position of having a great deal of plant on order and under construction, an overloaded heavy electrical industry, and the lowest growth rate they have ever experienced. Since that time, gas has greatly expanded its share of the energy market. Electricity growth has been low by historical standards, and the electricity boards have been retrimming their networks, which has inevitably meant a very low rate of ordering of new stations, including nuclear stations. I have given this bit of local history, local to the UK, I mean, not as any criticism of the planners, because their job is almost impossibly difficult, but simply to illustrate the difficulties in planning. Could they reasonably have predicted the freak smog in 1952, the new processes for gasification of light oil, or the presence of natural gas under the North Sea? In the long term, these factors will all appear as bumps on the curve, but in the shorter term, these bumps can lure us into predictions and decisions which can upset our calculations for almost a generation. Having illustrated one of the many problems in the long-term planning and, by implication, the reservations that must be applied to its conclusions, I think we will all agree that it is, nevertheless, essential. This is particularly so in capital-intensive industries such as ours, where the time from inception to completion of a project is so long. How do we do this planning to an accuracy that will at least guide us to the current policies for the development of our industry? First, if we consider total world energy consumption, it is clear that it has not followed a straight logarithmic line. Until the middle of the last century, world energy consumption was almost static, but then the spread of industrialization contributed to a fivefold rise by 1900, 3.5% per annum, when it reached 1,000 million tons of coal a year, other fuels playing no significant part. The rate of growth in consumption was thereafter much lower, taking 40 years for consumption to double again, 2% per annum. But in more recent times, the rate of growth has risen to 5% per annum, with oil and natural gas consumption growing at 8% per annum. These changes in growth rate in the past have probably resulted, at least in part, from the very inefficient use of fuel in the early days and the relatively efficient use in recent years. The effect of the two world wars has, however, also been significant, and if we are forecasting on the basis of the experience of the last 20 years, we must accept that we are assuming a level of world political and social stability similar to that which has characterized this period. I have no idea if this is a valid assumption for the period up to the year 2000, but it is very difficult to do effective planning on any other basis. Assumptions about the growth of population are also very relevant. We are all generally aware of the relationship of energy consumption per capita as a function of gross national product per capita, and a linear relationship is often assumed for simplicity. We have studied this relationship rather carefully, as it is of considerable importance, if not in predicting absolute growth rates, at least in being able to cross-check one set of assumptions against another. Let us consider a primitive society where the bulk of the gross national product derives from hunting or primitive fishing, that is, non-energy consuming industries. In such a society, the introduction of an additional energy consuming industrial unit will make a bigger proportional increase in energy consumption than in gross national product. In a highly developed, high energy consuming country, on the other hand, the introduction of a new energy consuming industry will result in a proportional increase of total power consumption much closer to the proportional increase in gross national product. If one plots on a logarithmic scale the energy consumption per capita and the gross national product per capita for the range of countries at different times, the changes fit remarkably well into a simple pattern. The relationship for each country seems to be following a predetermined course. Well, how does this help us? It enables estimates to be made of total useful energy consumption by extrapolating gross national product. As a statistic, this may be more reliable than extrapolation of the consumption of individual fuels, particularly at a time when the fuel mix might be changing quite rapidly. It is, at the least, another technique that might assist in the difficult job of planning. We have applied these extrapolations into a variety of countries, and the results are in good agreement with the estimates of energy consumption made by the United Nations Secretariat in their paper to the Geneva Conference on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy last year. In the case of the UK, they suggest figures somewhat above those being used in many planning exercises being carried out at the present time. Let me just mention that I have ordered a set of the proceedings. Of that conference, the so-called Atoms for Development Conference, in contrast to the previous Atoms for Peace conferences. They should arrive soon. On the world scene, we can expect total energy requirements to multiply by about 4 times by the year 2000, and we can also expect that by that same date, some half the world's energy demand will be in the form of electricity. So now we come to the question of the mix, and especially of the part that nuclear power will play in that mix. Now, how is that? That's an interesting question. How is that reflected in what has actually occurred? Well, that's a question for another time. There is no question that there are ample reserves of fossil fuel in the world to meet these demands. The world reserves of coal are enormous. As indicated by the estimates, by the year 2000, we shall only have consumed 2% of the world reserves. But this is not the problem we are facing. What is happening is that we are consuming the most accessible and most convenient fuels, gas and oil, fastest. And what is more, we are depleting most rapidly those reserves which are most conveniently situated geographically, economically, and politically. But this is nothing new. The situation is really not very different from that experienced in England 200 years ago, when the convenient forests were becoming depleted and coal had to be mined to keep us warm in the winter. Western Europe is not well endowed with fossil fuels. The coal is difficult to extract, and the recent discoveries of gas and oil in the North Sea, although substantial, are small in relation to Europe's total energy requirement. Without nuclear energy, Europe will continue to be very largely dependent upon imported hydrocarbon fuels, and with a mounting balance of payments and political dependency problems. Well, no change there. In the United States, coal reserves are very large, but there are clear signs that domestic production of natural gas and oil will have to be limited soon if reserves are not to be depleted too quickly. In Japan, reserves of indigenous fuel are small, and the country is to a very great extent dependent upon imported energy, mostly in the form of oil. In countries where the operation of large nuclear plants is a practicable proposition, there will be both economic and political pressures to construct nuclear capacity. The economic forces will be generated in attempting to avoid the use of less convenient fuels or having to transport fuels over long distances. The political pressures will be to seek to limit the ever-growing dependence of most industrial countries on imported oil and to reduce the cost of large energy imports. But turning now to reserves of uranium, we should appreciate that, at least as far as current designs of reactor are concerned, the position in the nuclear field is not dissimilar to that of fossil fuels. Uranium consumption in the world at the present time is small, and most of what is being produced is going into stocks and work in progress. The amount actually being burnt at the present time is trivial. As with fossil fuels, man exploits first. The richest and most accessible reserves and statements of recoverable reserves frequently mean uranium that can be recovered for less than $10 per pound U308. At this price of uranium, big nuclear reactors can generate heat at a price below that of fossil fuels, except in areas particularly favorable to them. But the world reserves of low-cost uranium, that is, $10 per pound as used in the present design of nuclear power stations, are small by comparison with the reserves of fossil fuels, and even substantial additional discoveries, which we must assume will be made, will not invalidate this statement. a major shift in the world production of electricity to nuclear stations of existing designs would, at some time in the future, increase the price of uranium to a point where the economic balance was restored. The time taken to reach this situation would, of course, depend upon the rate of installation of nuclear plants and the rate of discovery of new uranium deposits. He might also mention that the rise in prices of fossil fuels is limited by the pressure is reduced by installing nuclear. We can say, then, that the present designs of reactor have already had a major impact on electricity-generating pattern throughout the developed countries. They will, I am sure, very soon be proved a boon to the environment. They have added a new and important fuel to the list of energy sources, but the present designs of nuclear station cannot claim to have transformed the world energy position. The key factor which differentiates the nuclear power situation from the conventional power situation is nuclear power's potential. The transformation of the world energy picture by nuclear power depends upon the next generation of reactors, particularly the fast reactors. Prototype fast reactors are now under construction in several countries, and the first of these should start operation next year. These reactors can improve the utilization of uranium by about 40 times by comparison with today's nuclear stations. This high utilization means not only that our known reserves will deliver 40 times more energy, but, more important for the longer term, will enable the vast reserves of very low-grade uranium to be utilized without significantly increasing the overall cost of electricity. Uranium is a quite abundant element in the Earth's crust, but its compounds are relatively soluble in water, and it has become very widely distributed. However, with the high utilization possible in the fast reactor, even the extraction of uranium from seawater would be quite economic if no lower cost sources were available. Fast reactors will also be able to burn thorium, which is abundant in many parts of the world. The production of useful power from controlled fusion is another long-term possibility. The technology is, however, very difficult, much more difficult than fission, and so far nobody really knows how to do it on any practical basis. That does not say, however, that it cannot be done, or that it will not be economic when the time comes. But now let us consider what nuclear power can do for world energy supplies, and then, perhaps more important, what it is likely to do. It would be quite possible to build nuclear stations in greater numbers than we are now doing. Uranium mines could be opened quite quickly, and more enrichment plants could be built. Fast reactors are reaching the point when the first large commercial stations are being planned. It would be quite possible to build these stations in addition to or in place of existing nuclear designs. Small reactors could be built for remote areas. We have the ability to go nuclear very fast if we choose to do so. We could reserve our supplies of natural gas and oil for uses where nuclear power is not suitable. We could conserve our supplies of low-cost uranium by going to fast reactors. But what will in fact happen? All the world agrees that it would be a bad thing for the whale to become extinct. The only thing they cannot agree on is to stop killing it. But, to be fair, attempts are now being made to preserve the whale, and the efforts are now meeting with some success, although they have come very late. Nearly everybody would now agree that to burn pure methane to generate electricity is a waste this world will come to regret. But again, the issue is slowly coming to be recognized, and many suppliers of natural gas have recently regretted signing long-term supply contracts only a few years ago. Nuclear reactors of the present generation are capable of burning usefully no more than about 2% of the uranium they consume. Nuclear fuel will therefore be used most inefficiently, as coal was used inefficiently in our factories 100 years ago. But this will not trouble anybody in industry, provided he can see assured supplies at a reasonable price for 10 years ahead or until he requires, whichever is the longer. Anyway, when it comes to uranium supplies, so many people have cried wolf for so long that few people in industry will worry until the price really starts to go up very substantially. But perhaps in nuclear power we should take a slightly longer view. From early planning to operation of a nuclear plant can be 8 years, and we hope to get 30 or 35 years useful life from the plant. That is, we expect it still to require uranium in 40 years' time. We should keep a serious eye on uranium reserves and predicted consumption 20 years ahead. In a long-time scale industry, we have got to do our best at long-term planning. Against the argument for very rapid introduction of nuclear power on conservationist grounds must be set the real danger of becoming too dependent on new technologies before their long-term reliability and acceptability is demonstrated. So, what do I think will happen? First, nuclear power will continue to expand rapidly as it picks up the base load, and will then increase more slowly on a proportionate basis as it has to operate at lower load factors. Existing types of reactor will continue to be built for a considerable time in spite of their poor uranium utilization because of the investment in their manufacture and the experience and confidence that will have built up in operation. The fast reactor will in due course take over the job of providing baseload electrical power because of its low fuel cost and freedom from inflation in the uranium market. The speed at which it is introduced will be determined more by the rate of buildup in confidence in the system than minor differences in economics. The large-scale use of nuclear power will be spearheaded by the biggest industrialized countries where there is a large electrical demand and a strong manufacturing industry. The rate of installation will be strongly influenced by the economic balance between nuclear and fossil fuels. Finally, we must keep as our goal the supply of the major part of the world's energy requirement without burning fossil fuels. This requires the continued development of nuclear reactors, certainly the fast reactor for electricity generation, perhaps the high-temperature reactor for process heat, and possibly the fusion reactor for the next century. So, one thing that Sir John doesn't mention, that I thought I would bring up, having to do with the British nuclear power program in particular, which grew as rapidly, more rapidly than any in the world, so that Britain was the world's dominant nuclear power country, and then just as rapidly collapsed. Well, part of the problem, I have this set of what's called Nuclear Power Magazine, which I've read from before, which is, I've got 1967 through 1963, and it ended publication in 1963. I have the last issue. Anyway, so I have this magazines, and the early volumes, the 1957 volume, for example, starts with the ordering of the first commercial nuclear power stations, Berkeley and Bradwell, and the editor says, "Our national survival depends on building nuclear as rapidly as possible." It's coming out of a period where, from the Second World War onward, fuel shortages were chronic. And Britain had a terrible balance of payments internationally, partly because of the need to import combustible fuels. So with the ability to use 1 ton of uranium, as was said at the time, to replace 10,000 tons of coal, and ultimately to replace 1 million tons of coal once the fast reactor was developed, it was obviously much more favorable to import uranium than to import combustible fuels, which had no such potential for reuse. Anyway, but they built these Magnox power plants. The thing about the first generation of British nuclear power plants from Berkeley and Bradwell to Vilfa was that almost all of them were ordered before the first one went into operation. Berkeley and Bradwell, which generated about 100 megawatts apiece from two reactors, were ordered. And then the next year you had orders, and the next year you had orders, and the next year you had orders, next year you had orders. And the thing was, it took about five. So it was 1961 before Berkeley and Bradwell were in operation. And the last of the Magnox stations were ordered in 62 or so, Vilfa, right? And so they had thrown eventually 10 or 20% of the nation's electrical generating capacity into a system which they had very, very, very little proof would actually work as expected. And so many people were saying, hold on, we shouldn't have ordered all these nuclear power plants. We've got to hold up until we prove that they're actually going to run for 20 or 30 years rather than 5 or 10 years. But, of course, at that point, the industrial firms had tooled up to build nuclear power plants at a rapid rate. So what happened? Well, after Vilfa, there was a pause. They didn't order any more of the Magnox stations. Now, it turns out this was a mistake, because the Magnox station actually did work as intended. They were really as good as had been hoped for them. In fact, they, instead of lasting 20 or 25 years, they lasted 40 years. And instead of obtaining a burn-up of 3 megawatt days per kilogram, they obtained a burn-up more like 4.5. So their fuel costs were lower, their capital costs were amortized over a much longer period. They were just more productive than had been expected. So it would have been a good decision to keep on building them, but no one could have predicted that ahead of time. So that's kind of the clarity of hindsight problem. It's different levels of clarity, different distances, because from 1965, it was, oh, it's a good thing we didn't keep ordering all those Magnox stations. From 1974, it was, I wish we'd ordered 10 more. Anyway, coming up next is Geoff's new show, which is like Psytrance.